Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
What a thing just hovered sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I saw.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
This is edition 418 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight, Dave Frelott with his take on it, our British correspondent Stuart Miller, and in studio with me tonight is Canadian documentary filmmaker David Cherniak. He's been on the road making a two-part documentary, UFOs and the Politics of Reality, for the History Channel here in Canada. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Errol. It's so nice to be back after 4 months and talking to you. Once a month we talk from wherever.
From wherever it was you were on the road.
Last time it was broken down in Knoxville.
Your reckless vehicle.
Yes, it sounds like a good song, broken down in Knoxville. Yeah, it was a good song, let me tell you.
You mean to tell me you would prefer to be back here in Toronto where it's a balmy, what is it now, 3 degrees or 37 Fahrenheit? Rather than in the desert?
I live for 3 days. Well, in the desert's one thing, but I live for 3 days in a parking lot in Knoxville, Tennessee, the parking lot of the Ford Repair Center. They were kind enough to supply electricity and water, so I guess I should.
UFO life on the road.
The UFO odyssey, you know, that's what it's all about. Yep.
David Cherniak is in the co-host bucket seat tonight.
Yes.
He's a good director, too.
I'm a good host.
And you're a very nice man to boot.
Oh, thank you.
And that's why you only get booted gently. Brum-pum.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
It's good to have you back in Toronto.
I'll try and do my best for you.
And in the second hour of the program tonight, we should get into some of your road stories.
Okay.
I know you have several.
Many
that would fill more than an hour. But
some repeatable, some not.
Well, exactly. And it's still family radio at this time of the night on a Saturday night. Peter Davenport told George Filer of Filer's Files this week that a witness and his girlfriend and his brother were out when they saw a diamond-shaped craft, a couple of reports of diamond-shaped craft this past week, which was hovering about a half a mile away from them on September 30th around 10 p.m. He said at that distance it appeared as a reddish-white light, and after 3 or 4 minutes of hovering, the object began to move slowly in their direction. Ooh.
Makes you think.
It would worry me a bit, I think. It came to within 1,000 feet of them at about 100 feet up, and at that point the distinct lights on the craft were clearly visible. There were red rectangular lights in a cross pattern on the bottom of the object with many white lights. It was small, and the witness said he would think that only one or two people could travel in it. Well, is that human size or is that ET size? Yeah, exactly. He said the thing he was most amazed with was the absence of sound, and after it passed them by, his brother and he tried to run with it to get a longer look.
Triangular? It sounds like a kite.
Yes. The object was traveling at about 30 to 40 miles an hour, so needless to say, they couldn't keep up with it for very long.
Yeah.
They lost track of it in the neighborhood, and at 27, 26, and 24 years of age, it was the most amazing thing that they had ever witnessed.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, and probably will be the most amazing thing they've ever witnessed. That was in Illinois, in Joliet, by the way. In Nevada, near Fallon, two brothers were outside on a bike on Meadow Glen Drive on October 27th, on their way to their uncle's house, when one of the brothers noticed something flying really slow. They had thought it was just an airplane until one of them noticed it looked like a diamond, another diamond, and had no wings. It was a grayish-blue color and flying really slowly. It got real close to them and flew to their right. It was too fast with those movements until it was away from them, and that's when it slowed down again. One of the brothers screamed, and they pedaled real fast to get to their uncle's house. They were scared and wanted to get away as quickly as possible. They lost sight of the object when they got to their uncle's, who had come outside to see what was going on, and they wanted to show it to him, but it was gone. Isn't that always the way?
No, no, it's not always
not
the way.
Not always the
no,
way?
No, no.
You will tell
sometimes
us all about that
comes
later.
Sometimes the other comes out and they see it. Everybody waves and,
what
you know.
What the hell is that? Yeah. In Argentina, in Mercedes, Grupo Investigador de Fenómenos Aeroespacial, GIFAD, reports a case that involved two policemen during the first week of October as their squad car reached a railroad crossing on Calle 10 in Mercedes. I guess that's Highway 10 or Road 10,
Road 10.
They saw an intense light on their left hovering less than 200 meters over the fields. They stopped their vehicle to get a better look as the object moved slowly toward them. A dark circular structure with a red light at its core with a circle of continuous white yellowish lights passed over the car. They determined the dark mass's diameter was about 4 to 5 meters. Movement took place in absolute silence, they said. The object continued its flight slowly until it vanished towards San Jacinto. And our thanks to Scott Corrales, and through Scott Corrales to Guillermo de Jimenez, Planeta UFO in Argentina. Very strange days they are, and the reports, well, there are dozens and dozens of similar reports every week reported to Filer's Files and to Peter Davenport's National UFO Reporting Center and various websites around the world. If only we could put them all together on one website.
In one database,
it would be so useful.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
A very simple thought came to me today, and as it grew and grew, it made me realize something that has been staring us all in the face for millennia. Humans, as a race, are extremely vain. We're vain because we believe that unless we built it, use it, or have figured it out, it isn't possible. For example, we believe that there might be life on other planets, as long as it is inferior to life on this planet. Microbes, basic animal life forms, are all good possibilities for life on other planets in the universe, but life forms that can build civilizations, or you have to really be insane to believe this one, life forms that are more technologically advanced than us? No way. They cannot exist. And we trot out all kinds of theories to prove the fact. Based on the age of the universe, it is inconceivable for other intelligent life to exist on planets in or outside of our galaxy. Yeah. And the sun circles the Earth, too. Remember that, Jewel? Cost a few scientific types their jobs and lives when they tried to show that the Earth actually circled the sun. All of the races on this planet and all of the countries believe that they are the best, the smartest, the fastest, etc. Point in fact, is there a single Canadian that thinks any citizen from any other country is better than us at anything? It's bred into us from day one. We're taught that competition is everything, and being the best at what we do is the ultimate goal. But it's not just 21st century humans that think like this. We've been thinking like this from the moment the first human stood up on two legs and said, hey, I'm bigger than you are, you're still on all fours. The part that scares me in this realization is that the only way you can change your idea about this is when a technologically superior group comes along and boots your butt until you finally admit they exist, and maybe they are better, faster, or smarter. The Aztecs and the Spanish, the North American Aboriginals and the white man, Peloponnesian Islanders and the English, Portuguese, French, and Germans. It is almost as though we're scared to admit that somebody out there on some other ball of mud floating around in a vacuum could have been building cities 10 or 20 or 100,000 years before we figured out that picking up a couple of sticks and creating friction could build you a nice warm fire. But you see, it's nice to think that we're the big dog on the block. If we can't do it, nobody can. The basic laws of physics says it's impossible for whatever. Problem is, that concept assumes that we know all of the laws of physics. I'll give you a hint, guys. Maybe, just maybe, we don't know them all. There might be a couple of laws of physics that we haven't discovered yet. What we need to do is accept the fact that maybe humans are not the be-all, end-all group that we would like to think we are. If we can possibly get over ourselves, we might find that we are open to thinking there might be somebody out there that has figured out different economics or have developed their technology infinitely cheaper than we have developed ours. And they just might have a craft in their driveway that is capable of interplanetary travel. Think about this for a moment. 100 years ago, in 1906, it was pretty close to impossible for the average person to spend 8 hours of work any further than 30 or 50 kilometers away from where they lived on a daily basis. Nowadays, it's not uncommon for someone to live that distance and commute, either by automobile or mass transit to their workplace. 200 years ago, you worked no further than you could walk in the space of 20 or 30 minutes. Due to technology, we are now able to work further away from home than we ever did. Some of us work thousands of miles away while still working from the home with the aid of computers and the internet. In 100 years, or maybe 200, some of us might be working on a different planetary body. If our technology can bring us to that possibility, imagine a group with a technology that is 500, or 1,000, or even 10,000 years ahead of ours. If we can stop being so incredibly vain for a few moments and imagine this, perhaps we can imagine how a group that is technologically superior to us could exist, and if they do, how they could potentially be capable of coming here to visit their less intelligent cousins. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Vermont, every week at this time. Strange Dave, indeed.
Yes, Dave Furlott, who has the night off, that's a rerun from a year or so ago. An interesting one it was, too, on second listening.
It's a good piece.
David Cherniak,
degree in physics, University of Manitoba, I won't tell you what year, would say to Dave this, that he mentions 1,000, 10,000 years ahead of us. There's a simple astronomical fact that not too many people are aware of, and it bears a lot of relevance on the subject. The age of the universe is, as presently measured, 13.7 billion years. The age of this solar system, as presently measured, is 4.5 billion years. It's a 9 billion year difference. Give 2 billion years for the formation of heavy elements which are necessary to support the chemicals for life to evolve, and 5 billion years for that intelligent life to begin to evolve. You're still talking about civilizations. The first civilizations in this universe that were intelligent, assuming that they're there, are approximately 2 to 3 billion years ahead of us. That's a long time.
That's just a minor quibble, right?
Minor quibble.
Pick a number. Any number will do. They're much more advanced than we are,
well,
it would appear.
Yeah, and where's you know, this raises all kinds of interesting questions. When people always say to me, skeptical people, if they're here, why don't they say hi? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? My stock response is, when's the last time you leaned over to an anthill and said, take me to your leader?
Let's cross the pond
to
Cheshire in the United Kingdom. Our British correspondent, Stuart Miller, hails from that way. He's also the publisher of UFO Review.
Good evening.
It's been an interesting low point this week that's been going on over your way, isn't there?
It very much depends on your perspective. A low point or high point, I think there will be people that are happy about what's happened to Nick Pope, if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to, yeah. The Daily Mail this week put out a piece on Nick Pope that was headlined, Aliens Could Attack at Any Time, warns former Minister of Defence Chief.
Yes, but of course, Nick issued a public statement today, which you carried on UFO updates,
yes,
saying that, in fact, he didn't think that, or hadn't resigned from the, or left the MOD because of that. Although if you actually examine the words he used in the various interviews that he gave, he as good as did say that. What did he say? What he said was that the project that he used to work for has virtually closed down. That means that sightings in the UK are barely investigated, and that the consequences of getting this one wrong could be huge. If you report a UFO sighting now, I'm absolutely sure that you would just get back a standard letter telling you not to worry. These are the words, frankly, we are wide open. If something does not behave like a conventional aircraft, it will be ignored.
Yes, and it will fly eventually away.
Or drop down to the ground and the door will open and thousands of small aliens will rush out screaming at us and telling us to lay down our arms. We've actually had in the UK a couple of weeks of Nick Pope in one shape or form or another. It all started off really last week, and it climaxed on Wednesday of last week when a TV documentary was broadcast on UK TV about a UFO incident back in the early 90s, the Cosford Shawbury RAF airfield sightings in 1993. It was a very good documentary, actually, but some people alleged that it was balanced, weighted in the wrong direction. In a nutshell, this case was put down to rocket booster from the Cosmos 2238 space effort. What was interesting about this case was that it was heavily investigated by Bufora and Jenny Randles, and they claimed back in the early 90s to have solved it, in so much as they were saying that it had a rational explanation that it was debris from this rocket booster. The MOD continued to leave the case open as unsolved. So you have this bizarre dichotomy where the MOD, who are normally keen to write stuff off, have left the case as open, and ufology have said, we've got it sorted, we've identified what happened here. A lot of witnesses involved as well. When it became evident that the documentary was going to be shown, there was a lot of hoo-ha on various mailing lists, suggesting that they were going to sort of ignore the evidence and just try and build it up into something sensational. This was supposedly the case that convinced Nick Pope that, in fact, there was something to this UFO ET business after all. Nick Pope was very, very heavily featured in the documentary. And what happened was they did nod in the direction of the space debris, but basically Nick Pope said that the witnesses and the sightings, et cetera, didn't all add up. It didn't all fall neatly into one simple explanation, and that there was something probably anomalous about all of this.
So on the one hand, you have Nick Pope, who works for the Ministry of Defense running the UFO desk, saying that there was something more to the story.
And in fact, he was there at the time. He was on the desk at the time, and he investigated this. And his notes are now available because the file has been released by the MOD, and you can see what he wrote at the time, and so on and so forth.
So what's Nick Pope going to be doing now, in your estimation?
Following his business interests, whatever they may be.
That's kind of like spending more time with your family, isn't it?
Well, except that he hasn't got one.
Ah, well, then business interests come next.
No, he's one of the criticisms, and that's all you tend to hear in connection with Nick Pope, that are made sort of about him or against him, that he pursues a commercial
ufological agenda?
Well, yes, you see, it is actually forbidden. I'm not quite sure where or by who, but it is actually forbidden, generally, to try and make a living out of ufology. The reasons for this are unspecific and unclear, but I think there is meant to be some sort of slight immorality, or you are supposed to be giving something back if you take something out, or it is immoral to earn money. Or I'm not quite sure why it's wrong to earn a living out of ufology. I'm only guessing at the reason.
I think that was written by Duggan Dinsdale Piranha.
Ah, right.
Right, the unwritten law.
Right. In all fairness, and I'm quite sure Nick is not alone in this, but if you ask Nick to come and speak, usually he doesn't ask for a fee. Now, in all fairness, I know a lot of speakers in the UK follow the same sort of line as well. They don't ask for fees either. But it may be that Nick is, I'm just guessing, that's what he said in his public statement, that he was looking to sort of spend more time on his business interests. Those may be in documentary making, that sort of thing.
He actually didn't say much in his post to the UFO updates list today.
I think he was just trying to sort of make the point that he wasn't a nutcase, in as much as he didn't say that we're about to be invaded, except that he did say we could be invaded.
In his last paragraph, he says, I haven't resigned because of my belief in an imminent alien invasion, as has been reported in certain media outlets. That said, I remain convinced that the UFO phenomenon raises important defense and national security issues and believe sightings should be investigated in a proper and scientific way.
And the fact of the matter is, he wasn't really seriously misquoted. But one question that his statement did sort of clear up was the nature of his departure from the MOD, because, you know, he says in it that he resigned. Most of us weren't actually sure whether he had resigned or whether he'd been sacked. I don't think, to be perfectly honest, anybody would have been particularly surprised, not that I have any specific grounds for it, but I don't think anybody would have been surprised if he had been sort of sacked or his employment had been terminated. I must repeat, we don't have any specific grounds for thinking that, but there's always just this belief that his commercial activities somehow sort of conflicted with his civil service activities, and that maybe there's a limit to that if you work for a government department. It has been sort of Nick Popish fortnight, if you know what I mean.
Don't you have a civil servants union over there?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
So would he, as the chief of himself and his desk, his UFO desk, would he not be a union member?
Well, he would, but he's not been sacked. He
yeah, well, exactly. I mean, if he had been, then there might be some recourse.
Oh, yes. So we are unionized here. Sometimes people are sacked from jobs on solid grounds, Errol. It does happen. All I can say is, personally, I wish Nick all the best with whatever direction he's going in. I would imagine his business interests are tied in with the media, but I don't know that. But there are a couple of disturbing points, though, about the case that I was mentioning before, the Cosford-Shawbury RAF sightings. There are some people that did a lot of work on that case, a great deal of very detailed work, but were unable to tie up all the loose ends. It's a complicated case, even though there may be a very sort of straightforward solution to it. What has been very disturbing, listening to the people that have done all this work, is there seems to be one sort of ethic that stands out, and that is that if the testimony of a witness, if the detail that witness gives does not sit comfortably with other known facts, that witness, no matter how credible he is, and there were some incredibly credible witnesses in this case, that witness is wrong. And that is just bizarre. When these researchers, and this is what has gone on in the research in this case, people are turning around and saying, well, that policeman, that meteorologist, that RAF person, that this, that, they're wrong. Because although they saw what they saw, they are wrong about the time they saw it at, and they are wrong about the date they saw it at. And that's the sort of conflict that's gone on in this case, which makes it so sort of contentious. And you can then sort of begin to understand why, you know, people get aerated about. The other thing as well is there have been a fair number of interesting sightings in the UK over the East Coast. There's certainly been a couple of major incidents over the East Coast within the last sort of 4 or 5 days, 6 days, and nobody's paying any attention to those whatsoever. It's far more interesting to sort of fret over the ufological carcass of Nick Pope and just pick bits of meat off that. And for those people who watch this, who aren't particularly involved, and I'm really talking about myself here and like-minded people like me, and there are many of us who had no vested interest in the case and had no particular affection one way or the other for Nick Pope. You just watch all this and you're driven towards Nick Pope against your better judgment because of all the rubbish coming from the people that sort of object to him.
There certainly has been a lot of rubbish, and certainly today a piece of rubbish came my way. It's like any opportunity to take a run at Nick Pope will make its way out.
Do you think it's because he's government?
I think it's because he has a high profile and does a great deal of media work, and I think as a result of that, there is a fair amount of jealousy directed towards him.
Stuart Miller, thank you, sir. We're out of time again. I hate this, and I know you're anxious to go to bed because you have all kinds of things to do. Virtuallystrange.net. Go look at the program listings for tonight. You'll find links to the Nick Pope pieces and also to Stuart Miller's website, UFOReview.net. Thank you, Stuart. Good night.
Good night.
In studio with me, David Cherniak, who's been on the road shooting a two-hour documentary, yep. UFOs and the Politics of Reality. You talked to us, what, 4 or 5 times while you were on the road?
4 times, I think. Once
four
a month.
Times. Once a month. Yeah. The last time we talked to you, you were headed up the east coast of the United States.
No, I was stuck in Knoxville.
Oh, that's right.
I was broken down in Knoxville. Well, that lasted a weekend, and then we were on the road and heading for North Carolina, where we had an appointment with Frederick Durant III. For those of your audience who are unaware who Frederick Durant III was...
Condon?
No, Robertson.
Robertson.
1953, January, Fred Durant was the CIA man on the Robertson panel. Now, Fred says he was overt CIA as opposed to covert CIA, but hey, what's the difference, really, when you stop to think about it, other than one guy you know about, the other guy you don't. But that's
they're doing the same job.
They're both doing the same job. As a matter of fact, when I told Fred that the old adage that I heard, that the only ex-spook is a dead spook, he laughed. At nearly 90 years of age, he's still very, very, very much with us, very smart, and very enjoyable. We had a great time with Fred. Terrific guy. His attitude is kind of negative towards UFOs and always has been, but you know, when you ask him why, when you really get down to it, it's because at that time the scientists on the panel said there's no such thing. You know, when you really kind of take him to task a little bit, he'll back off a little bit. And when I hypothesized to him about, you know, Fred, I said to him, let's say you're sitting at the top levels of the American intelligence establishment around, say, summer, fall of 48, after the estimate of the situation has come in. And you're sitting there and you have a good idea that some of these things flying around are probably extraterrestrial, as the estimate said they were. What are you going to do? You're going to go to the American people and you're going to say, we think you ought to know that there's some people flying around and we think they're from somewhere else. And we don't know who they are, though, and we don't know what they're doing here. We don't even know whether they're friendly or not. All we happen to know is that they can fly rings around our fastest aircraft. But we thought you ought to know. Do you think anybody sitting at the top level of the American intelligence establishment is going to think like that? And Fred's response was, no, that would be irresponsible.
Or as C.D.D. Ryan once said, if I were the Secretary of Defense and these things were flying in and out of my airspace, I would deny that there was anything going on.
Well, I think you hit a key word there. It's deny, and I think denial. You know, I've been thinking pretty intensely about, well, what are the possibilities here? Just in terms of the early scenarios, I'm talking late 40s. And, you know, you don't need to have a crashed saucer in your possession. You don't even need to have gun camera photos to explain what went on at the top levels of the decision-making process for UFOs. All you need to understand is the process of denial. You don't really understand it. You don't really wanted to have to deal with it, so you deny that it exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. And that easily explains everything from, you know, up to 1952 just as well as a crash disk at Roswell, or excluding a crash disk, gun camera photos and everything else that they may and probably did have in their possession.
Mm-hmm. Right. The end of the last century, the phrase was plausible deniability.
Yeah, plausible deniability, exactly. That early history was quite fascinating, and so we dealt with Fred, and then I went on to heading north, as you said. We stopped in Philadelphia to interview David Jacobs.
How's David Jacobs?
David Jacobs is fine. David Jacobs is plotting out a new book.
On aliens?
Oh, yeah, on aliens.
Uh-huh. He's been very quiet lately.
He's been very quiet, and what he told me was that this will be the last word that he will have to say on the subject. And talking to him, and I can't say very much about what Dave said to me, but it sounds very much like it's going to be a very serious book.
More serious than the threat?
Well, proceeding from the threat.
Really?
Now, some of your audience is not aware of what David has postulated in the threat, so we should probably bring them up to date. But in the threat, which was published, I think, in 1999, David was talking about all the abductees who he's been talking to and hearing that not just hybrids are being created, but hybrids are being created with the idea of introducing them into our population surreptitiously, because they look like us, they sound like us, they're indistinguishable from us, except they think like them. Now, Dave's take on it is fearful that the idea is possibly that they want to take over. You could probably throw another interpretation on what's going on, but I think what David has done is address what is a fundamental question if you study the UFO phenomena, which is why all these thousands of sightings of low-level craft? One would think that if we're going to be observed by some or one or more civilizations, that one or two trips down to the surface, grab some soil, maybe grab a human or two to look inside them, see what how they tick, and then back up, you know, and then you can watch TV, you know, and follow what's going on with the civilization. So why all these hundreds of thousands of low-level trips? Well, Dave and Bud Hopkins and other researchers have postulated it's to abduct humans and to create hybrids for one or more reasons. Now, I can think that maybe there is another reason why so many low-level trips. Maybe there's hundreds of thousands of different civilizations that are just coming popped in, and, you know, everybody wants to come down and take a low-level look. And after they've done it, they go off, and then somebody else comes along.
And every one of those civilizations has different-looking beings and different-looking craft, and that's why we get all of these reports.
Could be. That's one possibility. You know, and there's another idea I had in terms of, okay, why bother to create a race of hybrids? Well, perhaps the breeding race is so far ahead of us that the possibilities of communication with us are very limited. So, like good genetic engineers, what you do is you create an intermediary race that can communicate with us because they look like us, so they're not going to scare us. And they think like them, so they can talk to them, and this will be a process in contact. Because when you start to consider the difficulties of a really advanced civilization as it moves about the universe, coming into contact with emerging civilizations on primitive planets like we are, it presents a certain amount of tactical and logistical problems. Like, what do you do if you just pop down out of the sky and say, hi, we're here? The primitive civilization, as we've seen on our particular planet, goes through paroxysms of cultural revolution and eventually falls apart. We've seen it time and time again on our planet. So you can't do that unless you want to, unless you're interested in taking over. But if you're really interested in incorporating them into your super civilization, how do you go about it? Well, it probably would have to be a very gradual process. And maybe that's one of the reasons why there's so many low-level flights. Maybe it's just acclimatizing us to the idea that there are people out there and they're well advanced of us. So that whole process of contact, we tend to think of it as the proverbial landing on the White House lawn. It may be a process that takes hundreds of years, possibly even thousands of years, and possibly necessitates some kind of intermediary hybrid race that's going to facilitate the process somehow. Who knows? I mean, these are things that you don't see discussed in too many places, but they certainly concerned me, and I thought about a lot as I was driving around. Well, I had a lot of time to think about things as I was putting 18,000 miles on this RV that took me around.
Through history, and if we look at some of the reconstructions of past history, some would say that already there are children of the gods on this planet.
This is an old idea. Mm-hmm. You encounter that, and it's a folk belief. It's a really strong folk belief. I spent a lot of nights in, dare I say it, Walmart lots. They're free, you know.
Yes.
And they encourage it where there aren't local ordinances forbidding it because they hate Walmart, specifically on the West Coast. So I met a lot of people, and a lot of people asked me what I was doing, and I would tell them. And you talk to them for 5 minutes. It's one of the first things that come up is the belief that we come from or have been influenced by people from elsewhere. It's so common, Errol. You know, I'm sure you find when you talk to people, too,
yes,
that it's just one of the most common folk beliefs out there.
And through all of the various tribal groups that there are on the planet.
Yes, very much so.
All the ancient tribes, they all have stories of the sky people, the gods from the sky.
Right, exactly.
Who came down and seduced their women.
seduced their women. There we go again. Yes. With the seduction of our women again.
Yes,
God damn it.
That whole virgin birth story, isn't it?
Yeah, the virgin birth.
Yeah, the angel came down and told me I would have a very special child.
Oh, let's not go there.
Not too far, anyway. Well, not too deeply, yeah. No. I don't want to get into that too deeply. I will offend a lot of people. But so David Jacobs has about had his fill with all of this now.
I don't know whether he's had his fill
but he feels that he shouldn't go on anymore.
I think he feels that he's about to write his final, that everything he has to say can now be really put into one book. That's basically it.
Professor Dr. David Jacobs is an assistant professor at Temple University.
Right.
And still has his tenure yet.
It's not likely that they can take away these things. I mean, tenure is like inviolable.
Well, they certainly tried with John Mack.
Well, they couldn't have tried with a better person to fight them at it. John gave them a really good battle.
Well, as did his wunderkind lawyer, Daniel Sheehan.
Yeah.
David Cherniak is with us here in studio. David was on the road for 4 months in an RV shooting a 2-hour documentary, UFOs and the Politics of Reality. I think this is David's 107th documentary.
Very close to that. I haven't counted them. If you count some of the series I did, yeah.
Yes. Well, Man Alive just packed them in.
I did a 26-parter called Spiritual Literacy in the space of a year, too. So that adds 26 to the total. That pushes me over 100.
A lot of David's documentaries have been transcribed, and if you'd like to read about the abduction program that he did.
Way back when,
1992, was it?
No,
82.
So I did one in 87 or 88 and another one in 92 for CBC. Yeah.
You can get to David's website and the transcripts from those documentaries by going to tonight's program listing at virtuallystrange.net and clicking Filmmaker, I think, is the link that takes you there.
It's www.allinonefilms.com.
There we go. www.allinonefilms.com.
And this is, I should explain, I shoot and direct and write and edit. I do all those things myself.
Yes, he's a multitasking man. But you did take Sarah Barnes on the road with you
researcher. Yes, I did. Well, as a researcher associate producer. Yeah.
Now, what was her attitude to all of this stuff before she went on the road?
Well, Sarah is a sci-fi fan.
Sci-fi and UFO
mix. But she was very open to the whole idea of extraterrestrial visitation. She didn't know much about the UFO phenomena, and getting her up to speed at the beginning was a little bit difficult because where do you send a person for one-stop shopping to get up to speed on the UFO phenomenon?
UFO updates.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to read through there, Errol. I mean, I tried to read it myself, as well, and, there's a couple of gigabytes of extremely interesting, but shall we say, scattered information.
Yes, you have to go through it, and yeah. It's coming up for, I think, 68,000 messages now. Yeah.
But, I mean, David Jacobs' 1976 book covers the field very adequately, actually quite brilliantly, up to about 1975-76. But after 75-76, you've got Richard Dolan's book, and that's mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. There's nobody who's actually attempted to synthesize the history since then. Richard Streithart, a lot of people have issues with the way he speculates a lot in his book.
Although Richard Hall's books, too, have been pretty useful.
Yes, they concentrate on the evidence. But if you really want the overview, you know, the social history, the yes. social-cultural history yes. of the phenomena, which is what my film is about. It's a social-cultural history mm-hmm. of the phenomena. Then there's not that many places you can go to. I basically mentioned them.
True. David Jacobs' book is much more academic. That's the one that he put there.
His PhD
Kansas
thesis.
University
That's right,
Press,
University yeah. of Kansas Press. His yeah. PhD thesis that was turned into a book. But it's still a heck of a good history.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Very much so. So at the end of it all, how did Sarah feel about her experience?
Oh, I think she enjoyed being on the road. She likes to travel. So she didn't come with me. She was only with me mostly during the time that I was the piggybacking the second documentary on
Gord
that,
Heath,
that was the
yeah.
Gord Heath documentary. But she's been doing a lot of research and a lot of pictorial acquisition as well.
Mm-hmm.
How does she feel about it? Well, I think she accepts that there's a real phenomena going on, and mm-hmm. the real phenomena has probably almost certainly been manipulated/covered up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, because Sarah's reaction to it is much the same as anybody else's who starts to look at it and not poo-poo, but right. go into it with an open mind.
This is what you find, and I have talked to a few debunkers, not of any of them on film, but one last week I was talking to a psychologist who shall remain nameless, who takes a very negative attitude, but you start to talk to him and you find out that, in fact, he knows very little about the UFO phenomena. The one interview I did do with a skeptic, so-called skeptic, was Seth Shostak from SETI,
mm-hmm.
right? I wanted to include SETI in this because I wanted to really explore the assumptions that underlie the SETI movement, or the SETI science, if you want. Because I never see that. You never see that in the media. Even Jennings, when they did SETI, they never explored the assumptions that the SETI search makes. SETI makes a fundamental assumption. You can't get from there to here, so you're going to stay at home and communicate via radio waves. That's a huge, huge assumption to make. And you never see them questioned about it. And I wanted to question them about that. And after I'd finished questioning them about that, then I asked him, you know, is it worthwhile talking about UFOs? And he said, I don't know. Well, what do you want to talk about? I said, how much do you know? He said, well, truth is probably not a whole great deal, but name me your best case, he said to me. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. That's a fool's game. It's not one best case. It's hundreds of best cases, which add up not to scientific evidence, but add up to compelling stories worthy of scientific investigation. And he was silent at that point, and we didn't talk about it further.
Yeah, I understand that he spent some interesting time with Stan Friedman on a cruise. Was it?
They did a cruise together yeah. where they debated. Mm. I mean, look, Seth is not completely close to the idea, and I don't think any of the SETI people do. Al Harrison, who's a psychologist, who's written a book about SETI, but is not in the SETI network, so to speak. Feels that SETI's attitude towards UFOs is basically political, that they feel they have to distance themselves from the UFO phenomena in order to get funding for what they do.
Well, isn't that the story of science and
yes,
UFOs?
Yes, although you talk to Seth and he says, no, that's not true. But I I don't believe them. To tell you the truth, I think there's a certain amount of politics that have to be played if you're going to go after funding to do something that is predicated on the fact that you can't get here from there. I'm getting hoarse. Maybe I'm talking a lot.
Well, that's what a guest is supposed to do.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, what's the hex of voice? I don't even.
You don't need it until you have to clean leaves and you can cuss very loudly again.
Speaking of cussing, I had a few incidents in the RV that taught me. What the RV taught me, Errol, was an enormous amount of self-forgiveness. After I had run into a tree, you know, or a tree limb from not looking up for about the fourth time and found myself cursing myself out with verbiage like that cannot ever be repeated on a show like this, which is for gentle people, I spent about 3 or 4 minutes just swearing at myself and stomping up and down in the RV, and finally I woke up and I said, what am I doing? What am I doing? It taught me self-forgiveness at that moment. But I wanted to get to Betty and Barney Hill a little bit.
And and before we get to Betty and Barney Hill, when's the delivery date on this documentary that you're in the throes of cutting?
Fall of 2007.
It's next year. It's barely a year away.
Yeah.
UFOs and the Politics of Reality, a two-hour for History Channel here. I have to say that I have looked forward somewhat to seeing a lot of the more recent documentaries, but I'm really looking forward to seeing yours, having spent so much time talking to you about what you've been doing.
I hope it's going to be an interesting documentary. I mean, certainly I find it an interesting subject.
It's certainly away from the usual cut and churn and stupidity of most UFO documentaries.
Yeah, this is the problem. Well, let's get to that through the Betty and Barney Hill.
Okay.
Betty, of course, died a couple of years ago, but her niece, who worked with her for, I think, 20 years, Kathy Marden, was around and was willing to talk to me only after Stanton Friedman actually said I was okay to talk to, because she had had a very bad experience with the company that was doing films for the Canadian Discovery Network, where they had made fun of her in their documentary, made fun of Betty, and actually asked her to sign a release that said it was okay if they slandered her, which she didn't do. She's a smart enough lady that she looked at the release and said, I'm not signing that unless this is crossed out. Well, of course.
An independent production
company. Company. It's astonishing how many bad documentaries there are on UFOs that either have very poor production value or are exploitative and
with
sensationalistic, with no research. They don't understand the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
How could you do a couple of weeks of research on the UFO phenomena and know enough to go out and do a film about it? I've been interested in the phenomena since I was 13, but in order to do this film, I still did 18 months of research before I went out and shot anything, and I still feel I don't know by any stretch of the imagination everything about the phenomena. It's fascinating about what Kathy said. I asked her where the site was because I wanted to go to the site. I was heading up that way anyways, and she told me the name of a road and gave me kind of directions to it, but she didn't tell me where on the road. She described certain things, but when I got there, I didn't find that the description matched. And what I did do, I had scanned a lot of pictures, and one of them was Betty standing on the road where they stopped the car. I drove up and down this 10-mile stretch of road a couple of times until I had narrowed it down with a picture on my laptop computer to the exact curve in the road, which matched where she was standing, except there were three pine trees on the right-hand side of the road, and when I looked at the one curve that it could be after I narrowed it down, there were only two. And I was thinking, damn, this can't be the right place. And then I thought, unless one of the trees has fallen down. So I went and I looked, and sure enough, there was one tree lying right where the third tree was.
So you found
the
place.
So I found it, yeah, exactly. Mm. There's now a new subdivision house kind of right on the spot where the craft apparently landed and took them aboard.
I wonder what goes on in that house.
These people have no idea. Nobody on the road, because I stopped, talked to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Nobody on the road had even an idea that that was the place where it took place.
But they knew about Betty and Barney Hill.
No, they knew about Betty and Barney Hill, but they thought it was like farther up the interstate or something. It was interesting.
You added $50,000 value to that home.
No, in fact, I didn't tell them. The right place, anyway.
The right place. So Betty's niece had problems with the media, and that seems to be...
I had huge problems all the time with people who didn't want to talk to me because I was a filmmaker. A lot of people required a fair amount of convincing before they would talk to me.
And then some didn't still.
And a few didn't still.
Which is too bad, because it would have been really good to have a couple of those people you wanted.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, one of them is ill. I think he has a good excuse. One other person, I think, just said, I'm not doing interviews anymore. Just flat out not doing interviews.
Sick of the media.
Yeah, tired of it. Been burnt. The Jennings special burned a lot of people.
Yep. Fairly horrible. I mean, what they did to Stan Freeman.
Yeah, it's terrible.
But he's still out there doing it.
No, Stan being burnt and stopping and even blinking?
Yes.
I don't know.
I'm sorry, I have to go on to the next symposium.
Really? Yeah, he wouldn't miss a heartbeat.
He's amazing.
The highlights of the 4 months, just briefly. Standing in the desert at Giant Rock. I know that
Split
it was the
rock,
contactees and all that, but it really is an amazing spot.
Yes.
There's nothing there but high school kid graffiti. They come in their ATVs and have beer parties and write their particular brand of graffiti on the rock and stuff. But it's still an amazing place. Southern New Mexico, around Alamogordo, White Sands. Amazing.
Oh.
Just utterly amazing.
White Sands, after the sun has gone down and it's still light coming from the ground. It's astounding.
It's an amazing place.
There goes the music. David Cherniak.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. It's been an experience, and we'll have you back, and we'll find out how things are going, and we'll check
in
with you.
I'd like to come in.
We can do it on the phone. You don't have to drive the RV here.
Hey, it was a rental.
Thank you, David Cherniak. Thanks, Scott from Brampton, Stuart Miller, Julian McNabb, and Jim Pacheco in Montreal. We shall talk to you next Saturday night. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.